So welcome, everybody, and thank you. Thanks especially to all of you who organized and set up and got us all cozied in here. And thanks to everybody for being willing to go on this particular ride with this particular material. I thought I would say just a little bit about why this, from my perspective, and then we'll find out on our own as we go along how it is for us. Why spend time with this particular story of the way? For me, especially this evening, there's a kind of poignancy to the question. Because I think we're in such a time of difficulty in our country and in our world, and we are so constantly asking ourselves, what do I do? How do I help? How do I even stand this? How do I get up in the morning? It calls me to want to look deeply into this way that I've been practicing for a while, and look at what are the special offerings, what are the particular offerings of this way? How does this way meet this? How does it help me meet this? How do I step deeply into it and meet it differently, because it's a different time? So what is this now? So I find those questions for me are quite vivid right now. I don't know if it's so for everybody. And since they are, I thought, well, here's this old story. It meets my kind of fascination with the meeting of enlightenment and endarkenment. You know, we talk often about our awakening being made of enlightenment and endarkenment. But we tend, in our koan way, to be a little bit more leaning towards the sudden experience where the koan comes and fetches us, right? And we say that our practice makes us fetchable, and then the light comes and zaps us. And it does. And there is never anything lacking. The gate is always open. And what about the daily do? What about the developmental aspects of our way? So we, especially in our tradition where we are a meeting of the Rinzai, the Linji, and the Soto way, there's a kind of interest in working with both. And so we talk about endarkenment as mixing it up with the grit of our lives, mixing it up with the grit of ourselves, going right into it, leaning into the difficulties, letting everything that comes up, every bit of us, be the stuff of transformation, right? And yet, I sometimes feel like we kind of shy away from the part that says, what is Zen? Zen is perfection of character. Zen is the perfection of character, it is said. Huh. Well, what about that? How is this way? What in this way? What in these practices is going to give me strength to do this? Right? Where is my courage coming from? Can you see how those are fitting together, those questions? So, the sudden and the gradual, yeah? Insight and understanding. And some of us have been studying, working with the Diamond Sutra, which keeps talking to us about unraveling what we've learned, the unlearning, right? The shedding, the stripping. And yes, we say yes to that. We know that when we get simple, when we just sit down and get quiet and let it fall, then the light fills everything. Yeah? And then we know that we stand up and we go do our daily do. And what do you know? Our old stuff is still present. And we're still struggling. And we don't know what to do when we hear the news. And we want to scream and shout and pound things. And so what? You know, what about this? What is workable here? So we talk about unlearning, freeing the mind of opinions and belief, and learning. And especially when we take refuge and when we recite our precepts and we study our precepts, our ethical teachings, there's learning in there too, right? The precepts say, you know, this, when you do this, it won't work out very well. There is that aspect of it, right? That's not an unlearning, that's a learning, right? You know, when you lie to somebody, it's not likely to do great stuff for your relationship. And and so that's the, you know, sort of on the ground nitty gritties. And so there is the unlearning, and then there's the making habits that support our maturation as human beings. Yeah? There is learning about how things are and how they work and don't work. And so what does our tradition, what do our ancestors and what does our experience tell us about how these work together? How do they get integrated in us? How do they become a whole thing? Is that making any sense to you, or these are not just questions I ask myself? Hopefully I'm not the only one. So I've been really curious to see how this particular story, this dream of awakening, the dream of the way, our pilgrim's progress, how does it access these questions? So this is not real easy. It feels, at the first, it's going to feel, I think, it does to me, at first feel like kind of an uncomfortable fit. And so what I propose is that one way that we can hold these is this, that, you know, with each picture of our little pilgrim girl or boy along the way, while we see that this is a stepwise, you know, developmental process, in a way, a process of unfolding, that we also keep on coming back to this, and on the other hand, right? So the story tells us from the beginning, look, there's nowhere to go here, right? There's nothing to accomplish. And that's one reason that all the pictures are in a circle, right? The circle stands for the wholeness and the brightness that's already there. They all happen inside of this circle of light. Yeah. So there's completeness already. At each point, we are utterly complete. There's nothing lacking. And we could use a little work, as Suzuki Roshi says, right? And so, holding that together, that sense of this is complete in itself, this is perfect, and where might it be going for me? Is kind of the way I've been messing with them. And so also I've sort of been thinking a little bit about Ken Wilber and his all quadrants, all levels stuff, where you are looking at actually the development of your awakening in all the arenas of your life. And so that you have sort of a three-dimensional sense of what you're doing. So you're looking at the physical realm. You're awakening in the physical realm. That's kind of interesting. You're awakening in private. You're awakening in community. You're awakening with respect to inside. You're awakening with respect to outside. Yeah? And so you might be, these, if you meet one of these pictures, you might go, oh, yeah, that's me in the physical realm, you know? And another picture you might look at and go, oh, yeah, that's me when I'm with my family, you know? Or that's me at work. And so it's kind of fun to play with these, not in a sort of rigid sequential way, but as a picture of something that we recognize about our lives, how we're meeting our lives. So perhaps I'm sort of more free, more at ease, more competent and confident in one realm than another. How might it help to see that? You know, is there a way that looking at that, I can feel a kind of welcoming of myself? You know, like, yeah, this is what I bring to this. And one of the cool things I think about Ken Wilber's ideas is that it's not a value judge. It's not a better than. It's like, okay, this is what I'm going to bring to this situation. And it'll bring that, right? And that may be, that will be something that becomes part of this. And maybe helps to not take it too seriously. So we get to watch events bump us, some of them, and others boost us. And then there are a couple of other things that I'm particularly interested in being curious about with this. It tends to look as if you're looking at, you know, little person training, you know, big ox, big mind, little self training, big mind. But, you know, it's, to me, it's interesting to flip it. You know, the who's training whom. And then to look at, well, what is training? So this is really just coming into relationship, right? And when there's not really two, in the fundamental sense, and yet we experience a kind of two-ness, how is it that we must make two-ness in order to dissolve it? Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. How is this a way that we sort of imagine a two-ness in order to make a union, to make a dissolving of the two-ness? And so how are we both just partners with each other? Me, myself, and I. and what if I play with it in that sense? Okay? And then also male and female. I think there's a kind of a... we can be curious about a kind of dynamic of male and female that's in there. In the stories, it's all male. But you know that's not true. And it's not true for men or for women. And so where is that kind of play in there? And then the other thing that I found coming forward was that sense of fortunately no one is watching. You know, this is from the Laban Pang story, right? Where Pang Lingxiao, his daughter, is with him selling baskets and crossing the bridge, he stumbles and she falls down next to him, right? And he says, "What are you doing?" She says, "Well, I saw you falling, so I'm helping." And he says, "Fortunately, no one is watching." And as I was looking through these pictures, I started to kind of have this, "Fortunately, no one's watching," feeling about this. And I think if we recognize that there's a kind of, there's this picture and a kind of intimate interplay of people, of beings, that has a little bit of that feeling of we get to be utterly foolish in this intimate way of life. And fortunately, no one is watching. I'm going to move into a little bit of history of these in a minute, but anybody want to chime in here? Anything it's making you think about or want to challenge or wonder about?
So when you speak about the other in the two-ness, it can be a two-ness within yourself and not just between you and that person across from you.
Yeah.
And bringing those two together.
Yeah. Anything else?
I kind of got stuck on the Zen is the perfection of character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd heard that before, and I'm just puzzling about it. I don't know what it means.
Good.
Thank you.
I don't either. It's an interesting statement to me. Perfection of character. Huh. Yeah. And so I think in our current American way of looking at things, we tend to reject that. You know? We tend to go, "Oh, well, I don't want any moralistic judgment laid on me." Right? And just be who you are and blah, 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 blah. Yeah? And I think in our particular tradition, we lean towards the, and you've heard me in talk after talk, lean towards the sort of other direction of, look, there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with just who you are as you are right now. Which is true. And
could use a little work.
And if we say that every bit of your crap is the stuff of transformation, then what do we mean by that? If we don't mean that that transformation which lets us be a bringer of joy to other people, you know, that lets us be somebody who can be helpful when things are tough, you know, which to me would be the perfection of character. So what do we mean by the perfection of character? What is character? I think we hold those questions. What is it for me? And I think it's not a trivial question, you know. What do I think is character? What do I want to grow up to be? Those are not stupid questions in the Zen context. But we tend to dismiss them in favor of there's absolutely no separation and none of this is quite real. It's not as it seems, which is all true. It certainly is my experience. And the thing that I call me, myself, is not a solid thing. So then, in this human life, what am I trying to mature into? What am I wishing to mature into? I don't think Zen ignores those questions. And that's sort of where, why I think this story is kind of interesting. If it's looking at what does this have to do with being the person who walks into the marketplace and doesn't look like anybody or anything, but things bloom behind them. You know, the final image of the story is of the old person just sort of waltzing down into the marketplace, just looking like nothing, sort of, you know, raggedy and nondescript, and dead trees bloom behind him, you know? And so, I want to be that person. Does that address that question at all?
Well, it certainly raises several others.
Good, fine.
You know, about all of this attaining. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's mm-hmm. this attainment, then all of a sudden one is grasping, and all of a sudden one is nitpicking attributes.
Nothing to attain.
Right. And mm-hmm. it becomes a bonfire of questions.
Okay. Beautiful. That's exactly where we are. That's what I think these stories are for, to raise that stuff and to look at where does that go? Where can that go? Yeah. And do we have to, does it, when we say there is nothing to attain, then what does it mean about aspiration? What does that say about aspiration? And we tend to just skirt that, right? Isn't that your experience? We tend to kind of, like, not go there.
Right, because that's not Zen. Oh, wait a minute. It is Zen. Wait a minute. It's not Zen.
That's kind of where I am, is let's sit in that discomfort. Yeah? Yes, but I do aspire to something. How is that? And there is nothing to attain. How are those two things true at the same time? What is it like to hold that lightly, to hold it provisionally, not to make a thing out of it? Right? What is it like to have deep aspiration, deep commitment, and not to make a thing out of it? There's no thing to attain. And then remember that your Heart Sutra goes on to say, after it says, since there's nothing to attain, the bodhisattvas, live in prajnaparamita, yeah, attaining anuttara samyak samodhi, right? That's where we are. It's exactly that tension, right? Yeah. Okay. And that's what I think these stories are cool for. They go way back. They have a history. let me think about the time here, because I want to. Does that sort of open up the field of this for you all? Mm-hmm. You see where what territory we're messing around in. It's not trivial. I mean, it really does have to do with what are we about here. And at the same time that we're about nothing, right? The Taoist part of us, the Taoist side of us, speaks right up and says, just be useless. Don't try to make this be something. Just sit and do it, right? Mm-hmm. Forget everything. So how do we put that together with being a moral human being? Okay. So, looking way back in history, I found some interesting stuff. And so, here's one that I brought for you. Elephants. Not oxes, but elephants. So this is, first, there was 11 qualities of good cowherd I just thought this might be interesting to you. You want to hear the 11 qualities of a good cowherd?
Absolutely.
You want to
I want to know if I have attained it.
Okay, good. Well, then I'm going to give you the straight version first, and then I'll give you the interpretation. This comes from the Mahagopalaka Sutta. So, old, yeah?
You weren't expecting a chorus.
Early days. Lists 11 qualities of a good cowherd. Okay. I'm going to do it as she because there's just so much he in this. So take it all as neutral, but it's she's turn. So she knows the cows by their form and color. She knows their distinguishing marks. She removes flies' eggs from them. She dresses their wounds. She fumigates the sheds with smoke to keep away the biting insects. She knows where to ford, you know, where you cross the river. She knows the watering places. She knows the pathways to and from home. She's skilled in locating pastures. She doesn't milk the cows dry, and she pays special attention to the leading bulls. We would all agree with that, right?
It's been my experience.
Take care of goats and
llamas,
critters and
horses.
Llamas. Yeah, so these are good qualities, right? For tending somebody, tending a critter. Okay, so these are to illustrate the conditions for the practitioner's spiritual development as follows. So that knows the cows by their form and color, you know, knows the elements, you know, earth, fire, air, water, knows what we're made of, in that sense. Understands that karma can make you foolish or wise, the distinguishing marks, right? That we all have, we all have personality from all the causes and conditions. And it's useful to, if we want to take care of each other, then we don't ignore those, right? To respond skillfully, and your own too, right? Removed fly's eggs they had as not giving into sensual thoughts, but knowing how to get rid of them. So remember, this is coming from the not so much the Mahayana. knows how to restrain her senses, teaches the Dharma to others in detail. That's the keeping away the biting insects, right? Mm-hmm. Purifying with smoke because it's helpful, right? And it turns out that smudging actually kills germs, I've been reading. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of, yeah, you can purify with smoke. Discusses the Dharma with other wise ones. That's knowing where to ford. Knowing where to go for what will help you cross the river. Right? Mm-hmm. Knowing where the crossing places are. Anyway, I won't go through the whole thing. But like that. So that was from a really old level of the tradition, that idea of what do you need to be tending your heart mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And so you can feel, at least I feel, a certain kind of sensibleness to that. Right? There are some things that are useful to know how to do in order to take care of your heart mind.
Kind of a, without putting too much weight on the word, but there's a morality in that path.
Yeah. Take care of business.
Yeah.
And be skilled, you want to get skillful about it. Yeah. And so you don't have to take it as a like judgment, but as a, these are things that are helpful. So then, And this one, this is not sequential, right? You can feel that. It's not sequential. It's just, this is what's useful. This is what you need to know. Okay. So then come the elephants. So this is a sort of pilgrim's progress from the Vajrayana depiction. And so this one is progressive stages. And we're not going to spend very much time with this. I'm giving it to you to take home, to enjoy. But you'll discover that it's really pretty much the steps and stages are amazingly like the ox herding pictures. And this is probably either ancestor of, or there was communication going on, or they just both cropped up in the same, you know, because they were useful. But for this one, and it's going to be a little hard to see in this light, at least for me, one thing that you'll notice is that the elephant starts dark and becomes white by the end. And the little monkey that's leading the elephant at the beginning is riding for a while and then kind of disappears. And that there's the fire of that there's fire in it, which is kind of wonderful. The ox herding pictures don't have this fire, but this is the fire and it disappears for a little while when you get all peaceful, and then see how it comes back at the way end. As the elephant turns around and is riding back, basically riding back into the marketplace, right? With the fire of love, which is energy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so there's the energy that starts you off on the path because you wish to. You can tell that there's a union. You know that there is something that is worth uniting with. So anyway.
But there's a rabbit.
Yes, there is a rabbit. The rabbit has to do with
he's pretty funny. But.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the rope of mindfulness and you know, the elephant sort of gets caught and restrained. The rabbit represents torpor, which gets to be more and more subtle. And this is something that we actually notice, you know, at the beginning of when you first take up meditation. Mm. A lot of people tell me, first thing I do is fall asleep. I don't know if any of you had that experience, but a lot of people, when they're first starting meditation, will say to me, I sit down to do meditation and I just fall asleep. Well, that just falling asleep just gets more and more subtle as we go along in our meditation and in our practice. You know? That feeling of I just want to curl up and go to sleep. Sometimes, when you read the news, can I just pull the covers over my head? Okay, so just take this one with you. But I just thought it was interesting to notice that this theme. I don't know. I guess where that went for me was the sense that this isn't just plucked out of nowhere. You know, there's something humanly appropriate about thinking developmentally. And so... there's also in the. I wonder what that is.
I think it's maybe a loose piece of siding or something, and this wind gets under it. Huh. That's what it sounds like to me.
Not the water dispenser.
No, it's outside. I think it might be the gutter.
Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah, gutter or something.
Okay.
It's our friend.
It's our musical accompaniment.
Which part of the story?
So there's also in the Lotus Sutra the parable of the burning house, where the in order to get the children to leave, the father keeps giving them, you know, stuff, and as they finally leave, he gives them a cart pulled by a white ox, which is to represent the largest, the great vehicle of the Mahayana, too, and so that white ox image is definitely there. And there's a koan where a monk asks Deshan, "What's the white ox on the bare ground?" Deshan says, "Moo, moo." What does he live on? Eat. And then I found there was one that was interestingly not linear, which was the womb realm mandala. It was a mandala in the feminine, and Vairochana is in the middle, the pure and clear Buddha, and you visit all of the eight petals of this lotus mandala, and each petal represents an attribute of the center. So rather than, you know, looking at a kind of developmental progression, this one is just saying somewhere along the way, you need to visit each of these aspects of Buddhahood. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really lovely. Mm-hmm. So I want to know more about that. But anyway, so then along came these ox herding pictures. And you probably already know that sometimes there were just five, sometimes there were six, eventually there were 10. And the version that most people use in Chan and on into Zen is has pictures and come and verses by Kuo-an Shi-wen, who end up being called Kaku-an in Japanese. Song Dynasty around 1100, Linji School. And he wrote the poems, and he or his disciple wrote also an intro. And so there's a little thing I'll read from Red Pine's translation, because I thought it would interest you. From his introduction. He says, the pictures by Jingzhi and Tsudewe showed the ox gradually becoming whiter until both it and the herd boy finally disappeared in the fifth picture, which consisted of a circle. And that picture is here, but it's not the fifth, right? There it is, that one. This was meant to point the viewer beyond... Oh, wait, sorry. To this... Tsudehue added a sixth picture showing the boy returning to the world unattached. This was meant to point the viewer beyond the emptiness that the circle seemed to imply. But this improvement must have reminded Pu Ming of the man in the snake drawing contest. Finishing his drawing before his competitors and not knowing what to do, the man idly added feet to his snake and lost. So Pu Ming chose not to follow the example, but instead to end his series with the circle of light. I kind of love that. He's like, I love the, you know, the old guy coming back into the marketplace, but maybe it is a little extra. Can we just trust that instead of having to like spell it out? Anyway, also by expanding the earlier five pictures into 10, he provided a commentary to one of the most popular Buddhist concepts, the 10 paramitas. And so his 10 can be a little bit like those 8 petals, right? So if you look at the verses of this one, which I was not able to copy for you, but I will, Jerry's left a copy out there, and tomorrow I'll leave a copy out there too. You'll be able to see how, in a way, it's not so much sequential as it is, well, there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this, that we get to practice the paramitas. Okay. So, let me just send these around. So these pictures are by a more modern person, 1989 or something. And so what I would like to do next is, are you all comfortable enough without getting up and walking? Are you comfortable just sort of moving around? Does anybody need a break? Because otherwise we will, we'll just take turns reading them. And just slowly and leaving a little space in between. Before we start that, does anybody want to bring anything more in?
I like the idea that it's not necessarily a progression.
Yeah.
But I have a hard time thinking of these without thinking of them as
a progression. Yeah. Yeah.
So that'll be interesting if we can overcome that conundrum.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, let's see what happens. And maybe it's not a conundrum, because maybe they both are and are not. That was why I brought in the Ken Wilber conception, because, yes, there is something that happens as you develop mentally, as you practice. Mm-hmm. We know that. We witness it. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And yet, there are those times when just being lost in the woods and having completely lost your ox and listening to the crickets is exactly the place to be.
Mm-hmm. And it may come after the emptiness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think that there is something that happens sequentially, and there is also the wonder of each of those steps perfect in itself. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where it goes for me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it will be interesting to sort of feel it both ways.
Well, just to play with this a little bit more.
Yeah.
You've said that the pictures are like dreams. Mm-hmm. And that does happen in dreams. Mm-hmm. Something from an earlier stage that you thought you'd already dealt with.
Yeah.
Just shows up.
It just shows up. And can we welcome that? Mm-hmm. Right? Can we be host to it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And be grateful that it's bringing something. Mm-hmm. And even in waking life, there are times when that being utterly clueless and not knowing what to do and not knowing how to find your practice and not knowing how to find any landmarks is exactly where you need to be. Yeah? So it is interesting, I think, that there is something, there's very definitely developmental
in this. I don't know, but I'm sure that everyone has had the experience, even just fleeting, of feeling not being aware of, not having any intention, but having that feeling that flowers bloom behind you.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know, walking around your flip-flops or whatever.
Right.
Ordinary. And just that moment. And then a dream comes that night, and the next day you're back to WTF.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And neither of those is invalid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have our preferences.
But we strive.
Yeah, exactly. And if it were not so that our enlightened nature, our fundamental Buddha nature, is present always and cannot be lost, then, you know, it would be more surprising that that happens. But you can't lose it, right? You can't not be on the boat. You can forget you're on the boat, mm-hmm. but you can't not be on the boat. So these paintings by Master Gyokusei Jikihara, 1982. But the verses are by Kuo-an from around 1100. Yeah. Now, just to make matters a little bit more interesting, I do have another translation. So what I'd like to do is just start someplace. Let's start with you, Kelly, and we'll just go around this way. And just each read a verse, and we'll be quiet with them a little bit. And we could... Let's see where we are then. Okay.
The Search for the Bull. In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. My strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night.
Discovering the footprint.
Yeah, let it just a little bit small. Let a little bit of space in between.
Discovering
the footprint. No, I mean.
I know what you mean. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I couldn't resist.
Go ahead. Okay. Never mind.
I know what you mean. Discovering the footprints. All along the riverbank under the trees, I discover footprints. Even under the fragrant grass, I see his prints. Deep in remote mountains, they are found. These traces can no more be hidden than one's nose looking heavenward.
Perceiving the bull, I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Here no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head? Those majestic horns.
Here.
Catching the bull. I seize him with a terrific struggle. His great will and power are inexhaustible. He charges to the high plateau, far above the cloud mists, or in an impenetrable ravine he stands.
Taming the bull. The whip and rope are necessary, else he might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, he becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, he obeys his master.
Riding the bull home. Mounting the bull, slowly I return homeward. The voice of my flute intones through the evening, measuring with hand beats the pulsating harmony. I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me.
The bull transcended. Astride the bull, I reach home. I am serene. The bull, too, can rest. The dawn has come. In blissful repose, within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes.
Transcended. Whip, rope, person, and bull all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors.
Reaching the source. Too many steps have been taken returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. Dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on, and the flowers are red.
Barefooted and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden, and I am ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. Now, before me, the dead trees become alive.
I have another translation of the same verses that would just sort of let you sort of hear them again a little bit differently. But we also have Red Pines. Even though they're they don't exactly correspond to those pictures, so But they're short, so I don't know how you feel about just sort of having these words wash through you, or if it's going to feel like too many words. I think it's going to feel like too many words. So I think staying with another translation of the same verses makes a little bit more sense. Does that for you too? Okay. I do have this that I could hand around. Where is the copy that doesn't have my scribbling all over it? It's in a pocket. Oh, I know where it is. Yeah, it's in the notebook like this that's on the table. I think. Loose.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the link that you sent with the abstract paintings and the poetry that came with that. That was beautiful.
Good. So you had a good time too.
I loved it. I downloaded it on my iPad. So
good.
So I could look at it again here.
Great. Yeah, I didn't actually print that one out. I just had it in my computer. Yeah, good. Okay. And that's not the John Cage. The John Cage one I'll bring tomorrow is more abstract than
I can't remember the other ones.
Than that one was. Yeah, great. Yeah, I was hoping that you would have a good time, just that I would just sprinkle those in beforehand. Okay, so here is this Urs App translation. And I think I sent you a link to this one. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that has a sort of lacy little pictures.
I printed that one out.
Yeah. Okay, so why don't I just read, I'll pass it around. So I'll start it and then we'll send it around. The first picture. Pushing aside the weeds of illusion, he looks for the ox in the wild, through swollen rivers and distant mountains. His path leads far and farther. His strength exhausted. He's in despair. There's no more place to search. Yet hear that lonely mountain autumn song. Cicada in a maple tree.
By a river among trees, footprints here and there, wild thickets, weeds, or did he now just get a glimpse of it? Deep into the mountains, his path leads far astray. Its nose may reach the heavens, yet would it leave no trace?
The song of a nightingale, listen. It's perching on a branch. Warm sun rays and a soothing breeze, green willows on the bank. Ah, there, no way to overlook it. Majestic horns, a stately head, a challenge for a painter.
Yeah.
I like that.
Don't you love the way it only shows the rear end of it?
Yeah.
So I think I'll just paint the other end.
Everything and all he gives and gets to catch the ox. What strength of will, what power. Too tough to shed at once. At times it suddenly struts up, up, to higher plains, to hide in mist and clouds, and rest in deep ravines.
Not letting go of tether and whip. Not even for a moment. He's careful not to lose his way. In the dirt and dust of the world, well tended and domesticated, the ox grows pure and gentle, without chains and bridles. It trails its master just so.
Riding high on the ox, he leisurely turns toward home, the sing-song of his flute vanishing in the evening glow, each beat, each note, full of infinite meaning. When one is in tune with the other, no need for chat and blabber.
Astride his ox, at last he reaches the mountains and hills of home. No more ox, the man is serene. Yet though the sun stands high above, he is still dreaming the dream, while the whip and tether lie idle in that thatch-roofed abode of his.
Whip, tether, person, ox, all is empty. Blue sky, all and all around, what is there to convey? How to keep a flake of snow atop a red-hot oven? Get there and you do accord with the founders of our school.
Returning to the root and source. Oh, what a waste of effort. Much better to have turned blind and deaf right at this very moment. Inside his hut, he does not see any object, nothing outside. Rivers flow onward by themselves, and blossoms turn crimson like that.
Bare-chested and with naked feet, he burst into the market, full of dirt and ashes, his face one big wide grin. No need for magic potions from adepts and immortals. He simply lets a withered tree erupt in blazing bloom. Funny how much a different translation can be different, isn't it? And yet. So, how about if we sit?